Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Welcome, welcome to episode 117 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and if you're a returning friend of the show, welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. And if you're a new listener, welcome to Game Master's Journey. In this show, we talk about RPGs from the GM's perspective, but we also bring in the player's perspective as much as we can. Lately, I've been doing a lot of world-building episodes where I'm creating my own homebrew D&D world, Primordia. Last week on episode 116, we talked about exploring different time periods in your campaign world as alternate campaign settings. So definitely check that out if you haven't already. Today, though, I'm going to take a break from the world building, and I'm going to talk about making rulings on the fly as a GM. Specifically, I'm talking about calling for roles that aren't necessarily covered by your system of choice. You don't need, and I would say you don't want, a game that gives you a mechanic for every little thing that the players could do. Once you've grasped the basic resolution mechanics of your game, you should be able to apply that knowledge to resolve any crazy thing that the PCs come up with to try. So I'll be using the current incarnation of D&D for an example today of how to do this, but you can do this with any game or any system. I want to remind you that I am going to do an episode in the near future on theater of the mind and how to better use theater of the mind as a GM. So if you're listening to this and you use theater of the mind in your game, I'd love to hear from you if you have any tips or tricks or any advice for a GM thinking about trying Theater of the Mind for the first time. Anything that you've discovered that makes it easier for you and makes it easier for your players. So a great way to send anything like that my way is just to email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. Now, before I get into talking about making rulings on the fly and coming up with roles that aren't covered in your game system, I thought I would talk about a piece of feedback that I got from a listener recently about the show. This comes from Jussi Linonen in Finland. So thank you very much for writing in, Jussi. I really appreciate it. And Jussi says, "Hi, been listening to your podcast from the GM Intrusion days, and I've messaged you before. Now I am on fire with the world-building theme that you've been talking about recently. I'm really enjoying listening to your show and your opinions, as I have noticed that they are quite similar to my own. I am totally stealing your ideas from Primordia to use in my own homebrew world that I'm creating. Awesome. Feel free to steal ideas, mine and other people's." Jussi says, "I'm also running a campaign there after your encouragement. I had almost nothing about the world as we started to play in the setting." And that's awesome, you know, because I don't know that was a conscious goal of mine when I started doing the world building episodes, but I know that my own thinking coming up, growing up in the hobby in the past was always that, you know, I needed to have all this front-loaded world building done before I could ever start to run adventures in a world of my own creation. And I started out running a lot of stuff in Forgotten Realms, and you look at Forgotten Realms, and there's literally encyclopedias of information on Forgotten Realms. So, you know, it was easy for me to walk away from that with the impression of, oh, I need all this information about my own setting if I'm going to run campaigns there. And the truth is, you don't. You really just need what's within your player character's field of view, right? Who knows what's on the other side of that horizon? So that's awesome that, you know, my approach has helped you to take the plunge yourself and start actually running games in your world in the very beginning. And I think it's a lot of fun, and it's a great way that you can get ideas from the players too, to help you out instead of cloistered all by yourself, having to do it all by yourself. So Jesse says, now I have taken many things from different campaign settings, mostly inspired by your podcast, also Game of Thrones, Eberron, the Iron Kingdoms, and Planescape. I like the idea of hopping between planes, but at the moment I'm toying with the idea of how to remake Planescape's plane structure to my own use. So Jesse goes on to talk more about his campaign setting and what he's doing. And I'm not going to go into that right now, although maybe in a future world building episode, I might bring some of this in. But really cool that you've gotten inspired to not only build your own world, but also to run adventures in your world from the very beginning. And also very cool that you're taking ideas from all over the place, from this show and ideas that I and the other listeners have, and also from other established D&D campaign settings, as well as things like Game of Thrones. And I think that's awesome, you know. And again, I just want to say that that's okay and that's great and that's what all creative types do. I think a lot of us, when we start thinking about creating our own world, we think that everything has to be original and we have to have all our own ideas and we have to do something completely different. And the truth is, you can do what Jesse's doing and you can do what I'm doing and take ideas from here, there, everywhere, from any kind of thing that you like, whether it's a world in a novel or a TV show or a movie or an actual campaign setting for the game you're playing or some other game. And I think that if you take enough ideas from enough different sources, that you are going to end up with something unique and truly your own, even if every idea you built on was an idea that came from somewhere else. Because the way that you combine those ideas together and the explanations you come up with for how and why those ideas combine together in your world is going to create something unique and something different, but at the same time is going to have a lot of these elements in it that players are going to recognize and that they can use as touchstones so that they can feel grounded in your world and have an understanding of it. I think that's awesome. So Jesse goes on to say later in his email, he says, I've been thinking a little bit about mechanics that would be nice to use in fantasy games, and I've come back many times to Dungeons & Dragons. Now, I'm just wondering if it's worth trying 5th edition, as we've played so many years in 3.5 and Pathfinder. I'd love to have some free-form character development without levels, but maybe 5th edition wouldn't be so level-focused. Also, I've been thinking that what if some items could grow in power through actions that the player characters take instead of levels? Perhaps something a bit like how you have renown in guilds and organizations. So yeah, I think that's a great idea. And as far as 5th edition, I mean, obviously in 5th edition, there are still levels. You still have character levels 1 through 20 and all that. But if you're looking for something more freeform and you're used to 3.5 and Pathfinder, I would definitely give 5th edition a try. If you go back to my episode called First Impressions of D&D 5th Edition or something like that, I'll have a link for it in the show notes for this episode at starwalkerstudios.com. But if you go to the show notes for that episode, I have in there linked, at least at the time, all of the free PDFs that Wizards has released for 5th edition. Among them, you can get the basic rules for players and the basic rules for dungeon masters. And then you can also get free PDFs for both of the Tyranny of Dragons books, as well as the Princes of the Apocalypse, Elemental Evil Players Options PDF. And I have all those linked in the show notes for that episode. And again, I'll link back to that episode in the show notes for this episode. So you can get a hold of those PDFs And there's enough there that you could run an adventure or even a campaign just using the free materials. And you can kind of see what you and your players think of 5th edition. But as someone who's familiar with 3rd edition and Pathfinder, it's going to be very easy for you to move into 5th edition. A lot of things are either exactly the same or very similar. You know, everything from what kind of bonus you get to what ability score, that's exactly the same. So it's a very easy transition to go from 3rd edition to 5th edition. And there's just 5th edition is much more streamlined than 3rd edition. There are a lot fewer fiddly rules to mess with. You know, a perfect example is, you know, in 3rd edition in Pathfinder, you have all these situational modifiers, right? Plus ones and plus twos and minus ones and minus twos for all kinds of things, from being surprised to hiding to flanking to having higher ground and all this stuff. And in 5th edition, all of that has gone away, and instead we just have advantage and disadvantage, which is something very easy to handle on the fly, which actually makes it fit into the theme of this episode really well. So I think because 5th edition is kind of a streamlined 3rd edition, and it's more elegant, and there's fewer rules to worry about, and it's much more along the lines of a philosophy of having kind of a basic framework that you as a DM can use to do whatever you need to do. I think it will be an easy transition for you. And I also think that you'll find it much easier to do your own thing with the system because there's fewer moving parts. So it's easier to see what the impact would be of a new spell you've created or a new magic item you've created or a new character ability that you've created or anything like that. And it also makes it easier to focus more on the narrative and role playing and things like that and not get so bogged down with mechanics and rules discussions and all that good stuff. So I definitely highly recommend that you try 5th edition. And again, you can get a lot of good experience with it without having to spend any money whatsoever and kind of come to your own opinion of 5th edition. And then if you think it's worth it, you can get the player's handbook. And yeah, I think the idea of having items that grow in power based on actions instead of level is a great way to do it in a way that you totally could do it. Now, in regards to the relics that I've come up with for my campaign setting, which are basically magic items that scale with level, I'm planning to kind of do a combination of both with that. And I actually took some ideas for this, I think, from the Legacies weapons. I think they were called in 3rd edition. They had a supplement on that. And I think I talked about on the show before, I had this weapon that I created in 2nd edition that scaled with character level. And it was kind of a one-of-a-kind magic item. I didn't at the time really pursue making that a class of items and coming up with a bunch of different items that did that. I just had the one item that did that. But I found that Legacies supplement really interesting because they were taking the same basic idea, but kind of building more of a system around it. And one idea I think that I got from there was that, you know, a lot of these items unlocking the higher level powers is not simply just a thing of, oh, I'm 10th level now, so now my sword does these new things. What I'm thinking, how I'm actually going to handle it in play, is the level requirement is a prerequisite. You know, you definitely have to have the level requirement before you can unlock the new ability. But there's also going to be some kind of story requirement. It could be you need to go on a quest and take the item to a specific magical place and do a certain ritual there to unlock the power. Or maybe you have to accomplish a certain deed. So maybe a sword for a paladin, you know, to unlock the level 11 power or whatever, you might have to go on a pilgrimage or do some selfless heroic act or something like that. And, you know, that would be something totally up to the DM to come up with for an item when she creates it. You know, what do you need to do to unlock this next level of power? Now, me personally, I probably, if I was starting at level one and planning to do a campaign up to level 20, and I was handing these items out, I wouldn't necessarily come up with all that in the beginning. I would probably come up with what the first requirement for the first power up would be, and then I would leave the rest up in the air and come up with those later as we approach that point in the campaign, because then I know more what's going on with the story and what's going on with the characters, and I can come up with something that really fits well. But, you know, I'm definitely going to have, you know, story elements on top of the level requirements where the character will have to accomplish something or do something. And sometimes it might just be like a money sink. Other times it might be a springboard for an entire adventure that the entire group needs to go on so that a character can advance their weapon or their item to the next tier. So I think you could totally do it just based on actions and remove the level element from it entirely. And, you know, for me, what I'm doing, I'm thinking of the level requirements are almost more for the dungeon master, to give the dungeon master a guide as to this is an appropriate time for the item to grow to this level of power. But I definitely would want to have things on the player side that are more deeds that they have to perform or quests they have to go on or exotic substances they have to find or something like that. So back to Jesse's email, he says, I really liked your episode about the different parts of your timeline being different campaign settings and how different eras in the same world can be very different. For example, in our world, the difference between Renaissance society compared to the Iron Age. And that's something I'm going to use in my world. And Jesse says he's also considering just putting his idea into my world and mixing them together, whatever. And yeah, man, you know, whatever you want to do. You know, we're just doing these worlds to run games for our friends. So, you know, you don't have to worry about intellectual property and stuff like that. If you're just running the game for your friends, you can steal from anybody, steal from me, steal from Tolkien, steal from Game of Thrones, steal from everything and anything, whatever makes your game better, whatever makes your world better. So thanks again so much for writing in, Jesse, and sharing those thoughts with us. Really appreciate it. And again, if you are building your own world, I'd love to hear about it, and you're more than welcome to write in like Jesse did and tell me about it. But I'd also really encourage you to go to the Game Master's Journey community on Google+ and share things about your world there. And we've had quite a few people do this already, and Jesse has talked about his world on the Google+ community as well. And then everybody gets to see it, not just me. And you can show it to other game masters in the community and let them see it. And it's just a great melting pot of ideas, all these people with very different worlds. But, you know, I think it's rare, if ever, that I could see something about someone else's world and not get some kind of idea from it that I can apply to my own world, no matter how different it is. You know, DM Nell has a very different campaign setting, and he's using a lot of spell jamming stuff in his campaign setting. But there are a lot of parallels between his world and mine, and I can definitely get some good ideas from other people's worlds.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
This is the part of the show where I take a brief break to give a thank you and a shout out to all the patrons of Starwalker Studios. Thank you so much, patrons. And I want to welcome a new patron to the fold, Jesse Linonen, who just gave us our feedback in the feedback segment, has become a tier 2 patron of Starwalker Studios. So thank you so much, Jesse. I really appreciate it. And I also want to give a shout out to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. So let's hear it for Jesse and Steve. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to all the patrons. I really appreciate it. And if you haven't checked out my Patreon page, now is a great time to do so, because I've recently revamped the patron award rewards, and I've really tried to maximize the rewards patrons get at the tier one and tier two level, which is $5 and $10 a month, which $5 a month, that's less than a dollar an episode. And $5 patrons now get access to my patron cast, which is a podcast I do just for the patrons on a monthly basis. And patrons can also get access to game material, mainly Primordia stuff, at least right now, that I upload for the patrons as well. So you can find out all about that by following the Patreon link at starwalkerstudios.com. There's a little Patreon button at the top of all the episodes. And yeah, thank you so much to all the patrons. And another great way that you can support the show is to go check out BattleBards at battlebards.com. And there you can get some awesome audio to use for your tabletop role-playing games. Anything from background music to monster sounds to incantations and strange languages. All kinds of great stuff to really ramp up the immersion at your table. And if you like what you see at battlebards.com and you want to try it out, definitely check out my coupon codes in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com, and you can get some free bonus tracks with your first order. All right, so for the main topic today, I'm going to talk about handling roles on the fly as a GM, and specifically handling roles that aren't explicitly covered by your game system. So, you know, even if you're playing Pathfinder, which is a very rules-dense system, you can probably come up with examples of things that a player character might try to do that aren't explicitly covered in the rules, where the book doesn't say, if player does this, here is the role that they make, and here is the difficulty of the role, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the more kind of rules light your system gets, the more and more of those situations you're going to find that aren't covered by the rules. And part of being a GM and part of what makes a good GM, I think, is being able to handle those situations in a way that's fair to the player characters and makes sense to everybody at the table, but also keeps things going, you know. And part of my problem with a game like, say, Pathfinder or Fantasy Flight games, Star Wars games that are so rules dense, is you can get into this headspace where anytime the players want to do something, you're flipping through the book trying to find the rule for that, right? And I really don't like running a game that's like that. I prefer a game where I can internalize the system and the mechanics and kind of the logic behind the system and the mechanics to the point where when a player wants to do something, I can just on the fly off the top of my head without looking in a book say, yeah, this is how we would handle that. I want you to roll this. Here's your difficulty. Here's your, you know, your parameters for success or failure or whatever. And I never have to look in a book. I don't have to stop the game or slow the pacing to handle that. It's just snap your fingers. There it is. Now, personally, I've found Numenera was a great game for that. That system is very simple and easy to internalize, and you can very quickly, even as an inexperienced GM, get to the point where you almost never need to look in a book to figure something out. And even if the players want to do something that is covered by the rules, you still don't need to look it up because you understand how the rules work. So you can just come up with the system on the fly. And if you look it up later, what you came up with will probably be what's in the book or close to it. Fifth edition D&D is another system that's very much like that. And personally, I prefer the fifth edition system over Cypher system just because Cypher system is a little too simple for my taste, especially as a player. It gets a little lacking in nuance, I guess is a way to say it, especially over a long-term campaign. So I prefer personally a system with a little bit more knobs to fiddle with, but without going so far that I start to feel confined as a GM. And for me, 5th edition D&D is hitting a pretty good sweet spot for that. You know, we have enough to work within the system that we can have true diversity in mechanics and how different roles are handled, and instead of everything being exactly the same, but it's still manageable to where you can wrap your head around how the whole thing works and come up with things on the fly and not have to look it up in the book all the time. So the question is, how do we do this, and how do we do this well? And, you know, what is a process that a GM can go through? So that's what I'm going to try to do today is, you know, for you newer GMs out there, or you less experienced GMs, to kind of walk you through how I would handle this if I'm in a situation where a player wants to do something, it's either not covered by the rules, or I don't want to take the time to find the specific rule to apply to that. So instead, we're just going to handle it on the fly. How do you do that as a GM? So like I said, 5th edition D&D makes this really easy to do. There are games like Numenera and Fate where it's going to be even more easy to do. And even in a game like Pathfinder or 3rd edition or Star Wars, that's more rules crunchy, you can still do this. It just may take a little more effort. And it also is going to probably require you and the players to be able to unleash yourself from the rule books and not be so concerned with looking up the specific rule every time, and instead finding a way to handle it that's fair and makes everybody happy, but keeps things moving. And you can still do that with those crunchier systems. You just have to free yourself of this perceived straitjacket of the rules that are around you, because it's all in your head. At the end of the day, the GM has the final say on how the game works. And doing what works for you and your table is always preferred to spending 20 minutes flipping through books trying to find what the writers of the game want you to do, because they're not at the table with you. So who cares what they want you to do? All right, so the first step in this process is you need to decide what kind of a role you're going to have the players make. So the player wants to do something, it's something off the wall or something that the designers of the game didn't anticipate or didn't feel was worthy to come up with a system for. So you've got to handle it as a GM, right? Or maybe it's just something you don't want to look it up. It's like, we're playing Pathfinder. Yes, there's a specific modifier for that somewhere in some book somewhere, but we're not going to waste time finding it. We're just going to come up with something on the fly. So I'm going to use 5th edition D&D for an example, because it's kind of hard to talk about this without giving you an example to work through, right? So in 5th edition, it's really nice because your basic task resolution system is pretty simple. You roll a d20, you add a bonus, and you're trying to meet or beat a target number, which is your difficulty or your DC. And that's basically it. And your bonus to the roll, for the most part, is going to come from an ability score, so strength, dex, intelligence, wisdom, something like that, and maybe from a proficiency bonus if it's a role that you would get your proficiency bonus to. And that's it. So unlike previous editions of the game, we don't have to go looking through books for all these different pluses and minuses to add to the role. For the most part, you're going to know what this bonus is, unless you're using an ability that you normally don't use. So maybe you play a wizard and you're doing a strength-based thing, and you're making an athletics roll, and you never make athletics roll as a wizard, so you may not know what that bonus is off the top of your head. But as a wizard, any role that uses your intelligence, you're going to know what that bonus is, right? Because it's always the same. It's your intelligence bonus plus your proficiency bonus. And your proficiency bonus doesn't change that often. It changes every few levels, every 4 or 5 levels or something like that. Unlike in earlier editions of the game where it changed literally every level. So it's much more streamlined. And another thing I like about the way it's handled in 5th edition is you have your skills, So for instance, persuasion is a skill. And then you have an attribute that you use with that skill. So normally, if you're making a persuasion roll, it's a charisma persuasion roll, which means you get your charisma bonus. And then if you are proficient in persuasion, you also get your proficiency bonus to that roll. But the cool thing is the system is flexible, and you do not have to always have persuasion be a charisma roll. It could be tied to another attribute if the dungeon master thinks that that's appropriate and that makes sense. So maybe in a specific situation as a GM, instead of calling for a charisma persuasion roll, maybe you would call for a strength persuasion roll. Now that this might work better with intimidation than persuasion, but there could be a situation where a character is trying to be persuasive and how strong they are is more relevant at that moment than how charismatic they are. Another example, I think probably a better example, is you might call for an intelligence persuasion roll, right? Maybe the strength of my persuasion is not based so much on how good with people I am and how well I can talk to you and convince you that I'm right, but maybe it's based more on the strength of my argument. Maybe I'm a very intelligent person and I have a very sound, rational, logical argument for why we should do a certain thing. And so instead of trying to convince you based on the force of my personality, I'm trying to convince you based on my reasoning and based on my perceived intelligence. So if I can convince you that I'm a smart person and that my argument makes sense, you might be persuaded. So calling for an intelligence persuasion role in that instance would make perfect sense. And you can do this with any skill in the game. And that's really cool. And so that would be the first thing that I would look at as a GM in the system. If a player is wanting to do something, first ask, what skill might apply to this? And then ask what attribute might apply to it, right? So each skill by default has a certain attribute associated with it. So like persuasion is associated with charisma, but you don't have to use charisma. So my first question would be, does a skill apply? And if so, which skill? And then the next question would be, which attribute best applies? Is it the one that's normally associated with the skill, or is it maybe a different attribute? Now, one thing to understand in D&D that will make this process easier for you is the different types of roles that exist in the game and what you use those different roles for. So the first type of role that we have in the game is the attack role. And attack roles are used to hit something or in a case where accuracy is important. So for example, if you're playing the fair game where you have to throw a ring around a bottle or a bowling pin, that would be a great time to use an attack roll. Even though the character isn't being violent, even though they're not attacking something, an attack roll would still be appropriate there, because just as throwing a rock to hurt someone takes dexterity or strength, depending on how you're going about it, and your attack bonus or your proficiency bonus would apply, the same thing with throwing a ring around a bottle. It makes sense. Now, the thing to know about the attack roll or to understand about it is your attack roll factors in the relevant ability, which is usually strength or dexterity for physical attacks, intelligence, wisdom, or charisma for magical attacks. It also factors in your character's level in the form of your proficiency bonus, assuming that you are proficient in the attack that you're making, but usually you're proficient in an attack roll. So, you know, a time when you might not be is when a character is really doing something outside of their wheelhouse. But in fifth edition, usually if you're making an attack roll, you're getting your proficiency bonus. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind when deciding, you know, what kind of role do I call for? Ask yourself, would the character's ability in a certain attribute apply? Would that make this role easier or harder? And in fifth edition, at least, pretty much an ability is always going to apply. I can't think of a role other than a death save in the game where some ability score isn't applying to that. So really the question isn't, does an ability score apply? The question is which ability score applies, which makes the most sense, wisdom, charisma, intelligence. And, you know, you can look in the player's handbook to get descriptions of the different ability scores and what they'd be used for. And one thing to pay attention to, and we'll talk about saves here in a little bit, is look in the section on saving throws and where it talks about the difference between like a charisma save versus a wisdom save. And that can be very enlightening and help you kind of decide which attribute best applies to what this player is trying to do. So the attack roll has an attribute associated with it. So if you're doing something strength related, someone who's stronger is going to have an easier time at it. It also has the level figured in it. So is this action something that would be easier for a higher level character to do than a lower level character? And if the answer is yes, then maybe you want to use an attack roll. The difficulty of an attack roll is usually the armor class of the target. So if we're talking about a bona fide attack roll in a combat, then it's their armor class. How hard is this person to hit? In a case where armor class maybe doesn't make sense, like for instance, tossing the ring around the bottle, you could just assign an appropriate difficulty, 5, 10, 15, or 20, just like you would any other kind of roll. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's all kind of semantics. So for instance, tossing the ring around the bottle, whether you're looking at it mentally as a DM and saying, oh, I think the bottle would have this armor class, so you make that the difficulty, or whether you're just looking at it as, I think this would be a fairly difficult roll, so I'm going to assign a difficulty of 15. Either way works. Personally, I'd go with the way that's either easier and or just makes the most sense in that situation. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. What matters is you need a roll. You need to be able to tell the players, this is what you roll. This is where you get your bonuses from. And you need a target number for them. That's all that matters. How you derive those is up to you. So obviously, if the player character is making some kind of an attack, you're going to use an attack roll. But you can also use an attack roll if it's something that involves hitting something with accuracy. So some other examples might be tossing a lasso around a hook. So like the classic, you're in a jail cell and you fashion a lasso out of a belt or something, and you're trying to hook the key, you know, the key on the hook. And, you know, that would probably be an attack roll, you know. And in that situation, personally, I would probably say, okay, that's going to be a dexterity-based attack roll. So you're going to add your dex bonus and your proficiency bonus to the roll. And I'm not going to worry about what would the armor class of this key on a hook be. I'm just going to look at it. How difficult is this to accomplish? And say, okay, that's going to be difficulty 20. So you need to get a 20 or better on the roll. Another example might be throwing a rock to break out a specific window in a building. And you can use normal attacks to guide you. If the character is using a spell in some way, then use a spell attack. If the character is using a melee weapon or a tool or their hands, use a melee attack. If they're throwing something, then just like with thrown weapons, it can be dex or strength, and the player gets to choose. If the tool that they're using to do the task is something that would be equivalent to a finesse weapon, then you could also let them choose between strength and dex. So maybe what they're trying to do, you're like, well, this seems sort of like a melee attack, even though it's not an attack. So, you know, we'll adjudicate it like it's a melee attack. But maybe they're using a tool that's really light and delicate. And so you might say, but I would consider this tool to be a, quote, finesse tool. So you can use dex instead of strength if you want. That kind of thing. Just what makes sense. You know, and don't be afraid as a GM to get feedback from the players. You know, a lot of times what I'll do when a player is doing something that's not covered by the rules is I'll say, okay, I think this makes sense to do a dexterity athletics role, and I think the difficulty would be about 15. What do you guys think? Does that sound fair? You know, and then a player might make an argument of, oh, well, actually, I think it should be acrobatics instead of athletics. And if their argument is sound and makes sense, then go with it. And if not, then just explain, well, no, you know, and I've had this happen a lot with climbing in my games, because a lot of times players want climbing to be acrobatics because they have a dexterity based character and acrobatics is a dexterity skill, and they want to use acrobatics instead of athletics for climbing, or maybe they're not proficient in athletics. And I always say, you know, at the end of the day, to me, climbing is a strength activity. You know, when I was in elementary school or middle school or whatever, you know, in gym class, whenever they wanted us to climb the rope, I could never climb the rope because my arms weren't strong enough to haul myself up the rope. It didn't really matter how dexterous I was. If I wasn't strong enough to pull up my body weight, I was never going to climb that rope, right? So, you know, for me, I would say that climbing is strength, and I would say it's normally athletics, but with a certain character or in a certain situation, I could see it being a strength acrobatics role instead, especially maybe if they're climbing down instead of up, I could see acrobatics coming into play. But again, it all comes down to what makes sense to you as a GM and what makes sense to the table overall. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the GM has the final word, but if all your players are thinking that what you're doing doesn't make sense, I would definitely discuss it because, you know, you want to all be on the same page, right? So there's your attack role. So, you know, this crazy thing the player wants to do, ask yourself, is it an attack role? Another possible role that it could be is a saving throw. So saving throws are used to resist things. They're also used to represent a reaction on the player's part. So making an attack roll or making a skill check is an active thing. It's a thing where the player says, I want to do this thing, and then you call for a roll to see if it succeeds or not, right? Anytime something is player directed like that, it's an action, and it's going to be an attack roll or an ability check. A saving throw is a reaction. It's something is happening to the character, and you're calling for a roll to see if the character is able to avoid it or resist it or overcome it in some way. So a saving throw represents a reflexive action. So that's the way I always think of it is, you know, is what's happening, could that be a reflex? And if it's a reflex, if it's something that just happens automatically, like the doctor hits your knee with a little hammer and your leg goes up without you even trying, that's a saving throw. So if something happens that the character doesn't expect and they have a split second to react to it, that's a good time for a saving throw. And they're inherently defensive in nature. If the character is being active, you know, they're doing something that calls for a roll, then a save isn't appropriate. Saving throws bring in a character's ability score. I mean, literally, any of the ability scores are a saving throw in 5th edition. So you have a charisma saving throw and a constitution saving throw. And they also bring in the character's level in the form of the proficiency bonus if it's a save they're proficient in. So, you know, in a way, this is very similar. I mean, in a way, all the roles in 5th edition are similar, right? They all come down to ability score bonus, and maybe you get proficiency bonus, maybe you don't. So with saving throws, most characters have two saving throws that they're proficient in that they get from their class, and then some characters might have additional saves that they get proficiency in through a feat or a class ability. Now, you can find some guidance on which attribute to use for a saving throw on page 238 of the Dungeon Master's Guide. And definitely check this out, but I'll go through these real quick. There's a little table. So for instance, for strength saves are used for opposing a force that would physically move or bind you. Dexterity saves are used for dodging out of harm's way. Constitution saves are for enduring a disease, poison, or other hazard that saps vitality. Intelligence saves are for disbelieving certain illusions and resisting mental assaults that can be refuted with logic, sharp memory, or both. Wisdom saves are for resisting effects that can charm, frighten, or otherwise assault your willpower. And charisma saves are used for withstanding effects such as possession that would subsume your personality or hurl you to another plane of existence. So again, that's on page 238 of the DMG, and you can use that to guide you as to what kind of a save would this be. And I think you could see through all those examples how those are all passive things where you're resisting or avoiding something that's happening to you by reflex or instinct or automatically without the character really having to initiate an action. I think another way to look at saves versus other types of roles are, is this something that a character is doing as their action in a turn, right? Usually if a character is making an action, they're using their action in a turn, then it's going to be an attack roll or an ability check. It's not going to be a saving throw. A saving throw a lot of times will happen on someone else's turn when someone is trying to do something to the character, and then they are making a save on the other creature's turn. I would love to hear from you what you think about today's topic of handling roles on the fly, especially roles that aren't covered in the rules. And you know, where do you stand as far as in game? You know, are you going to stop your game to look up a rule, or do you prefer to just handle it on the fly? And if you handle it on the fly and then it turns out that it is different than a rule in the book, do you tend to stay with the ruling you made on the fly and say, well, this is a house rule now and this is how we do it? Or do you tend to retcon, say, or say from now on, we're going to do it the way it's handled in the book? I'm just curious. I'd love to hear from you. Any comments you have about this episode or about any other episode or the show in general, you can reach me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter @LexStarwalker. You can follow me on Google plus LexStarwalker. And also check out the website, starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. You can find the show notes there, and you can find all kinds of links to my YouTube channel, Facebook, Reddit, all that good stuff, all at starwalkerstudios.com. Our third type of role in 5th edition is the ability check. And this is kind of the default role. And you can also see that the other two types of roles, the attack roll and the saving throw, are really just types of ability checks. Really all roles in 5th edition are ability checks except for death saves. At least that's the only one I can think of. So if an attack roll or saving throw isn't appropriate, then ability check is the default role that you would go to. And again, an ability check, just like the other two roles, calls upon a particular ability score, and you get the bonus from that ability. And also the character's level, again, comes into play in the form of the proficiency bonus if the character is using a skill that they're proficient in. So that also kind of reflects your class, right? And the same thing with saving throws, because your class is what determines what saving throws you get proficiency in. So you're, you know, not only is your level reflected, but also your class, because for instance, a fighter is going to be good at strength saving throws while a wizard probably isn't. And the same kind of thing with your skills, that is reflecting both your character class and your background, because you get some skills from your background as well. So the first thing, if you decide that this role is going to be a skill check, is again to determine the relevant ability. Is this strength or dex or constitution or whatever? And to get guidance on that, check out the Player's Handbook, pages 175 to 179. And that goes through each of the six ability scores and gives you examples of the types of actions that those scores would apply to. So usually determining the relevant ability is pretty easy to do, as long as you understand those six abilities and what they're used for and kind of how they break things down. But if you're ever unsure, I think if you check out the examples on pages 175 to 179 of the player's handbook, that you'll be able to make a decision. It'll be pretty easy, I think, for you to figure out with those examples. And as you get practice with this, you know, determining if a given check should be strengths or dex or intelligence or wisdom or charisma just becomes second nature after a while. You can just do it at the snap of your fingers. It becomes really easy. So first you determine the relevant ability, if I could talk. And then second, you determine if a skill would also apply. Now, there are going to be times in 5th edition where it's just an ability and it's just a strength check or it's just a constitution check. But ask yourself if a skill could or should apply to this role as well. And a way to help decide whether or not to have a skill apply is first, of course, does it just make sense that a certain skill would apply to this role? But another way to approach it is also, do I want the characters background and or class to factor into how good their chances of success are, right? If you're calling for just a straight ability check with no skill, then the only bonus they're getting is from their raw ability score. And so that is best used for something that's just innate ability. It's not something learned or something where having skill or training would be of any use. Right. So honestly, it can be hard to come up with things where it would only be a raw ability and there would be no skill involved. You know, like when I try to think of something, the first thing I think of is, well, how much you can lift. Lifting a heavy object seems like, well, that's just strength. But then I think about it for a minute and I think, well, there's actually techniques to lifting. And depending, you know, what kind of object you're lifting and what you're trying to do with it, I could definitely see athletics applying. You know, if you know proper lifting techniques and you've practiced lifting and whatnot, I could see you having a bit of an easier time than someone who's equally strong as you but doesn't know those techniques and doesn't have that experience with lifting lots of heavy things. So, you know, me as a GM, it's usually pretty easy for a player to argue that some skill would apply. Now, you know, we might have to decide what skill exactly applies, and we might disagree about that. But, you know, it's going to be hard to find an instance where you couldn't make an argument for some kind of skill applying to that. And second, kind of like I discussed before, if you decide that a skill would apply to this role, don't be afraid to use non-standard ability skill combinations, like a strength acrobatics role or an intelligence perception role or a dexterity athletics role, right? That's the beauty of the system of having on one hand our abilities and on the other hand skills, and we can combine them in different ways. That's the beauty of it, is it can be very flexible and you can use it to come up with fair ways to adjudicate kind of off the wall things that make sense. So again, don't assume just because it's an athletics role that you have to use strength, or just because it's an acrobatics role, you have to use dexterity. Consider other possibilities, and maybe something else just makes more sense. At the end of the day, though, as a DM, you should use your best judgment, and your best judgment trumps the rules always. All right, so step one was deciding what kind of roll we need to make, whether an attack roll or a saving throw or an ability check. The second step is, now that you've decided what kind of roll you're going to ask for, you just need to assign a difficulty to that role. And again, 5th edition makes that very easy for us. It is recommended that you simply assign a difficulty of 5, 10, 15, or 20. You don't have to worry about all of those numbers between 1 and 20. You only have to worry about those four. And the guidelines to when to use which number are very straightforward and easy to apply. So you can find the guidelines to this on page 174 of the Player's Handbook. And actually, this chart goes higher than difficulty 20. It goes up to difficulty 30. And here are the difficulties. So DC5 is very easy. DC10 is easy. DC15 is medium. DC20 is hard. 25 is very hard. And 30 is nearly impossible. And again, this whole section in the Player's Handbook, starting on page 173, is a great reference for how to determine what roles to use in what situations and what difficulties to set. So, you know, I tend to personally focus on 5, 10, and 15. Difficulty 20, that's a, you know, a difficult role, and those are going to be few and far between, at least in lower level games. Difficulty 5 is very easy, and a lot of times, if it's that easy, I won't even call for a role. And kind of my rule of thumb for whether or not to call for a role is the chance of failure dramatic and interesting, right? There are times that a task would be difficulty 5, and I just don't call for a role because I'm not really interested in what would happen if the PC failed that role. And in fact, maybe the PC failing the role is going to disrupt the flow of the game, or it's just going to mean that they have to wait longer before going on to the next thing. And it's just going to be a bummer. And I'd rather not have it happen. And even with the difficulty 5, there's a possibility, at least with lower level characters, that they might fail. So if you don't want them to fail, just don't call for a role. And then they are not going to fail. But, there might be times where I'm like, this role is very easy. It's only difficulty 5. But if the PC manages to fail, that could be interesting or dramatic or funny. So I'll call for the role. Difficulty 10 is kind of your standard. You know, it's not so easy that we're going to consider not even having a role for it. But it's also not super hard. Chances are good that the PCs will succeed. And then difficulty 15 is something more challenging. And then difficulty 20 is this thing you're trying to do is really hard to do, and on from there. So, you know, that's a much easier way to handle it than having difficulty 6 and difficulty 7 and difficulty 11, right? You only have a handful of numbers to worry about, and it's pretty clear cut the difference between a DC 5 and a DC 10 roll, or a difficulty 10 and a difficulty 20. They're pretty clear delineations. And this is very similar to, for instance, Cypher System. You have difficulties 1 through 10, same kind of thing. So a lot of systems are going to, at the core, have some concept like this of just deciding on a scale of how hard this thing is to do and then assigning an appropriate number based on that. Now you want to decide, are you going to share this number with the players or not? And there are good reasons to do it or not to do it. Personally, I'm not someone that believes that you always should share the difficulty or that you never should share the difficulty. It just depends on the situation. A lot of times I think about, would the character know if they succeeded or failed or not? And if it's a situation like, for instance, a perception check where there's no way the character would know if they succeeded or not, then I'm not going to share the difficulty because they wouldn't know. Or in a situation where is it possible for the character to gauge how hard the thing is to do, right? If you're trying to climb a mountain, especially if you have any experience at climbing, you can probably look at the mountain and get at least some idea of how hard it's going to be. So maybe I'd say it's difficulty 20 to climb, or maybe I'd just say it looks really difficult and not give them a number, but give them an idea of it's going to be, you need a high roll. So again, that's up to you as a GM. You know, I would just ask myself, would the character know how hard it is ahead of time? And would the character know if they succeeded or failed? If it's something that they know how hard it's going to be and they know if they succeeded or failed, then you might as well just share the difficulty number with them. It kind of speeds things up a little bit. But if it's a situation where they wouldn't know and you think it's dramatically appropriate that the player wouldn't know, then you don't have to share that number. All right, so step one, we decided what kind of a role to ask for. Step two, we decided what the difficulty of that role is going to be. And now step three, we're going to decide if there are any other factors that would come into play. And in 5th edition, this is simply going to impose advantage or disadvantage. If factors are going to come in play, but you don't think that they're important enough or relevant enough to go so far as to impose advantage or disadvantage, then you can just disregard them. They're not relevant. Again, you know, this system is not super granular, so it's not meant to reflect every tiny little variant that could happen in the world, right? That's where DM creativity and player creativity comes into play. So ask yourself, is what the PC is trying to do especially difficult or out there, you know, kind of crazy? Is it so much so, either difficult or out there, that they should have some kind of disadvantage or have disadvantage? Maybe what the PC is trying to do is the perfect solution to the problem, and maybe because of that, it's actually easier for them to do, and they should get advantage. So, you know, here's a cliche for you. They're trying to break into a manor, and the guard dog's running at them, and a player character decides, I'm going to throw a raw steak on the ground, and you as the DM have already determined that in order to keep the dog mean, the owner doesn't feed it very much, and it's really hungry. So you might decide, well, them throwing the raw steak on the ground was actually like the perfect solution to this problem because the dog is really hungry. So I'm going to give him advantage on the roll to do that, just as an example. Or another possibility is maybe what the PC is trying to do is just really super cool. And you just really dig that they're trying to do that. So you don't want to give them advantage on that roll because maybe the super cool thing they're trying to do is also really difficult. But that's a great time to award inspiration if they succeed. So our fourth and final step after we've determined what kind of role to ask for, what the difficulty is going to be, and whether there's any kind of situational thing that would apply advantage or disadvantage, our fourth and final step is to call for the role and adjudicate the results. Now, depending on the game that you're running, depending on the situation and what you want to do as a DM and how much time you kind of want to spend with what's happening at this moment, this could be as simple as just pass-fail. They meet or beat the difficulty, they succeed, they don't, they fail. It could be that simple. Or you might consider degrees of failure or success. So a character who succeeds at a roll by 5 or more might be particularly successful. So you say it's a difficulty 15 roll and they roll a 20 or higher, maybe they got some bonus on top of just what they were trying to accomplish. Maybe things really went their way. On the other hand, a character who fails by 5 or more might fail quite spectacularly. Another possibility is a character who only misses the roll by 1 or 2 might still succeed, but at a cost. So maybe the character is in the jail cell trying to hook the key off of the hook with the lasso, and maybe they only miss the roll by 1 or 2, and you really like what they're trying to do, and you don't want to spend time with them trying over and over and over again. So maybe you say, okay, you succeed in hooking the key and getting it off the hook, but it falls to the floor and makes a loud sound when it hits the floor, possibly alerting the guard in the next room or something like that. So this whole process took way longer for me to explain than it actually takes to do in real time at the table. With a little practice, you can make these kinds of calls in a split second. Now, if you're running a different game than D&D, you're still going to go through the same steps. You're just going to adjust the specifics to match the mechanics of your particular game. So, for instance, if you're running Numenera instead of DC 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, or 30, you're going to be assigning a difficulty between 1 and 10. So you're doing the same thing, just slightly different based on the mechanics of the game you're running. Once you understand how the basic resolution mechanics of your game work, you can easily figure out how to do this with pretty much any game, any situation, any time. Now, I will say, you know, again, the more bloated and complicated a game system is, the more difficult this becomes. You know, it's a little harder to do this with Pathfinder, for example, than it is 5th edition D&D. And it's a little harder to do in 5th edition D&D than it is in Numenera. but it can still be done. And again, you know, if you're playing a more kind of granular system, like you're playing Star Wars or you're playing Pathfinder, you know, you can still do this. And the best piece of advice I can give you is get you and your players to kind of lighten up on the rules a little bit, you know, and have a discussion with the table and say, look, guys, you know, I know in the past we've been really concerned about getting every rule exactly right and everything. And although I think that that's somewhat important just so that the game is fair for everyone, I feel like we've played the game enough that we have a good enough grasp of the system that we can kind of take those training wheels off now and we can get over our dependency on the rule books. And I want to, during play, solve these problems that come up or these situations and determine how to handle them on the fly as a group, as opposed to taking time to look through the book. And I'm going to make rulings on the fly. They may not match what's in the book, and that's okay, because what's important is that we have a fair way to resolve the situation that comes up in game that everybody understands and that everybody feels is fair and makes sense and is logical and reasonable, right? That's what matters, and that we keep the game going. That's much more important than flipping through hundreds of pages of rules and getting it just, quote, right. And if you can get your players on board with that, or at least get them to give it a shot and say, hey, for the next few sessions, we're not going to open any books during play. We're just going to do it on the fly. I think if you get them to try it, they'll like it better. Because, you know, for me, when I'm playing in a game, the points that I'm most likely to get bored or lose interest or immersion are when we're stopping the action. It's like the movie's on pause while we're flipping through books trying to figure out how something works. I would much rather, as a player, the DM just pull something out of his ass and say, this is how we're going to do it, and we keep going, even if it's, quote, wrong or different from what's in the book, then we spend a bunch of time, you know, looking it up. So that's my perspective as a DM, and it's also my perspective as a player. And I think even in a, you know, very mechanics heavy group, that if you get them to try it that way, I think at least some of the players will come around and dig it. You know, now you're going to have your munchkins sometimes that, you know, made this broken build and it really depends on every rule being exactly the way it is in the book so they can get this probably unfair advantage over everybody else. And that player may not be happy with you being more loosey-goosey, but that's okay. You know, not every player works out in every group, and not every group is for every player. And if you're not the kind of DM that wants to spend a lot of game time looking up rules and you don't want to stress about the rules, then having a, you know, rules-focused munchkin player at your table is probably not a good fit for anybody anyway. So do what makes you happy as a GM. I guess that's my final piece of advice. Do what makes you happy. And, you know, for me personally, keeping the game going makes me happy. And being able to make calls myself creatively and logically makes me happy. And just keeping the pacing going. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 117 of Game Master's Journey. Thank you so much for coming along on my journey as a Game Master. I really appreciate you listening, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from other GMs how you handle roles on the fly and any tips or tricks you have that you'd like to share with me and the other listeners. I'd love to hear from you. So I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Stanko, Transboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.